You can holler, you can applaud, you can scream, you can do anything you want. I can't hear you anyway.
Welcome to Salt Lake Dirt. I'm your host, Kyler Bingham. Today, I welcome Brad Listy to the show. His latest novel is called Be Brief and Tell Them Everything. He's also the host of the Other People podcast with Brad Listy. This has become one of my favorite podcasts as of late. It's been going on since 2011, and there is over 800 episodes currently. Interviews with today's leading writers, just great conversations. I've learned a lot from listening to the episodes that I've listened to. So check it out. Everybody's on here. You know, some of my favorite writers like Jonathan Ames, Jerry Stahl, Bruce Wagner. Really incredible conversations there. Check it out. I'll have links to where you can find all of Brad's work. But yeah, let's jump into it and talk to Brad Listy on the Salt Lake Dirt podcast. Thanks for listening. Brad Listy, thank you so much for joining me today. This is very cool for me. If people aren't aware of his podcast, the Other People podcast, definitely check that out. And he, you know, of course, he's an author. I just finished his book, Be Brief and Tell Them Everything, which I loved. So yeah, Brad, thanks for being on the show today.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So, I guess I'd want to jump in just kind of talking about the book itself, Be Brief and Tell Them Everything. So I finished it the other day. Absolutely loved it. It came out last year. So I think almost about a year ago it came out. And I would just love to hear. I didn't really read anything about it. I just wanted to read the book and, you know, get the vibe from just reading it. It says a novel. Too. So, and it seems very autobiographical. I'm just curious about how the concept came to you and kind of the process. And I guess just tell people about the book.
Well, I think it's a lot of trial and error. There were multiple, as the book itself attests to, there were multiple failed iterations of the book where I tried to write around the difficult stuff that I was going through in my actual life, or I tried to write something completely different and it just wasn't working. And then eventually, and you know, this process unfolded over the course of a decade, and eventually it got to the point where the book that was eventually published became a book that is about its own creation and spoke directly to these kinds of frustrations and leaned into the difficult personal stuff that I had been going through, my family had been going through. And it's not that uncommon of a story for writers to kind of do this dance over the course of the process of writing a book, to do whatever they can to avoid having to engage with painful stuff. And the irony is that once you do finally surrender to that stuff and you lean into it, what tends to happen is that the writing gets better. The book begins to work and readers tend to respond. So go figure.
Yeah. Well, I definitely responded. I mean, I had it on my Kindle and I don't tend to, just because I have a hard time focusing reading on my Kindle, but this was a book that I know it's a good book if I can read it on my Kindle within a pretty short amount of time. So I felt like reading the book, I felt like I was talking to a friend who was opening up to me about their life. And, you know, it was like that. It felt like I felt so many of the same things that you were portraying on the page. You know, I think one line just made me laugh, something about like the character gets off of Twitter and it's like social media is like a dad in khakis crashing a house party. So it had
me on social media feels like that.
But I know there was a lot of stuff like that, that it had me laughing, and it was, it had a lot of, just truth and vulnerability on the page. And, it was incredible read. And I just felt so connected to it. This is kind of like a book. I don't know if I read it on your website or where, but, kind of in the vein of my struggle, as far as like interweaving the real events that's going on in your life, with like the process of putting out the novel. So I think that just intrigues me so much, being able to be that open with your reader, kind of laying it out there. I mean, there's some pretty intense stuff that happens, with the miscarriages and, the friends that you grew up with that, died suddenly. How was putting that on page? Was there any kind of like, trepidation or holding back? Or like you said, once you start letting go, the writing just gets better. Was there an initial block, I guess, is what I'm asking, when you started putting down these very personal stories?
Well, it's actually kind of complicated, because I think, as I was just saying, like, there is some resistance, and you do try to write around it, even if you're not conscious of the fact that that is what you're doing. You think you're working on a project, like the way that it actually feels when you're doing such a thing is that you feel like you're pursuing a project that has nothing to do with this difficult stuff. And as you work through it, you find that there's no life in it, and you're either not interested or it's just not working creatively. And then eventually you abandon it in frustration, if you're me. So there's that aspect of it. And then what's interesting is that there is also a part of the process for me that involved overdoing it. So there is an iteration of this novel. My wife and I, and the main character in the book, and his wife, suffered through 5 miscarriages, which I don't recommend if you can avoid it. And I wrote an iteration of this novel that went through all 5 of them. Ugh. That was not a fun book to write, and it was an awful manuscript to read. My poor agent. So it works both ways. I think what I learned the hard way, which like seems to be the only way that I learn anything, is that it's a balancing act. Like, you do have to lean into this, into the tough stuff, and you do have to slow down where it hurts, which is like one of my favorite writerly sayings. And I always have to give Steve Almond credit. That's his line. So, you have to do that stuff. You slow down during the hard parts. But you also have to be judicious with the hard parts, because otherwise you're just bludgeoning the reader. And really, I think writing in granular detail about one miscarriage is plenty for the reader. I mean, you don't have to do all 5, even if there are circumstantial differences. Like, the fundamentals are the same. And so it's that kind of back and forth that characterized the process. And ultimately, it was about finding the right balance, making sure that I was delivering an authentic emotional experience for the reader, but also delivering a book that is entertaining, that has humor in it, which is important, I think. It's kind of like the spoonful of sugar that helps the medicine go down when you're trying to write about difficult stuff. It never hurts to have some jokes in there, but of course the jokes have to land and they have to feel right. So you can't just be arbitrary about it or too slapstick about it. It's got to feel like the measurement is correct. So this is the challenge. This is the tedium of trying to write a novel. And I don't think it's, I don't think it's particular to my book. It's all books. There's some kind of version of this where you're going back and forth and you're trying to sort it out.
Mm-hmm. One thing I related to quite a bit was in the book. So like I'm working on a project right now, and kind of putting yourself as the writer, you travel places or you do things to try to get, like, I don't know if it's like a sense of trying to control everything or what, but at least that's how, in my experience, like I'm going to go to this town and in the middle of nowhere and outside of this tiny town in Nevada or whatever, and hole up for a few days and just write and walk around town. And then after, you know, there can be some cool stuff there, but then I'm also like, what am I doing here? Like, what is this? So I felt like it was cool seeing that on the page with, not that the character didn't get something from it, but like the trip to Israel, the trip on mushrooms, kind of like leading up to this idea of I'm going to get, I don't know if inspired's the right word, but I'm going to take so much from this experience and it's going to go into my art. And then at times, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it felt like when I do stuff like that, it never, not that it's a, not that I shouldn't have done it, but it never works out the way I'm kind of thinking it will, you know, and it's good for what it is, but it is funny. I think a lot of people, but I don't think I've ever seen it on the page before. So it was really like, I got a lot out of that. Like it was funny. It was frustrating. I empathize with the character. There was a lot that I related to in those passages. So maybe you could speak to that a bit about like putting yourself in situations as the writer to hopefully get more material or just insight or whatever. And then maybe it doesn't go quite the way you had planned. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, I think there's a legitimate case to be made for doing field research. I think that's a real thing. I think writers can benefit from going out into the world and, you know, if there's a particular location, as is the case for my protagonist, but like, you know, there's just to give listeners some orientation, in my novel, the protagonist is talking about a failed iteration of the book. And this failed iteration is about a guy who tries to sell one of his kidneys to a dying stranger in Israel. So having never been to Israel, having no real idea of what it's like there, he's not Jewish, you know, he's got no context. So he's struggling with the book, and he decides that a way to hasten things or to end the struggle would be to go to Israel and see it with his own eyes. Not the worst impulse in the world, but I think that sometimes if you're anything like me as a writer and a creative person, you can maybe hope that doing something like that, like making some kind of grand gesture, is going to somehow prove to be the like magical elixir, or it's going to lead to some hugely generative period of creative output. It's going to be the thing, you know, you can convince yourself that it's the missing piece. And then you go and you spend like $4,500 to fly halfway around the world for 3 days. And then you come home and you realize that it was kind of all for naught. That can happen too. And I think maybe it's an issue related to self-awareness, awareness of the status of your creative project, like how far along it actually is versus how long or how far along you wish it were. And I think, you know, because again, this book hews pretty closely to my own lived experience, though there's plenty of fictionalization in there. But I did go to Israel and did have a similar kind of experience. And one of the great triumphs of this novel is the fact that I was able to work that trip into the book so that I could tell my wife like it wasn't a complete waste. it just took 10 years longer than I thought.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I mean, 3 days in Israel. I haven't heard of that before. That's impressive. That's quite the whirlwind.
It was. I mean, and you know, as we're talking, Israel's in this state of like political, like heavy political unrest. So it was I was actually like really taken with the country. I thought it was such a beautiful place. People are beautiful, great food. Wish I could have stayed longer, but my daughter was just a baby at the time. So you can imagine I was feeling like I got to get there and get home. So maybe one day I will return.
That's great. So, so did you went to school in Boulder, Colorado. Were you a film student then?
I was, yeah. I was not a very good or engaged undergraduate student at all. But I was a film major, they tell me. I think it's worth noting, and I think probably it's changed it's changed a lot just at the level of technology. Like, I was right at the cusp of, if you can believe it, the transition from actually cutting celluloid, like physically cutting film strips. I was at the cusp of that, and then the transition to digital. So the transition to digital editing in the university context happened like a year or two after I graduated. So I was on a moviola cutting celluloid and never really loved filmmaking per se. I always wanted to be a writer. I liked the screenwriting part of it, but I just didn't really know what I wanted to do other than to be some kind of storyteller. I wasn't that interested in being in school when I was 18 and 19 years old. I think I would have been a great candidate for a gap year. I was kind of one of those people, but it didn't happen. Hindsight's 2020. And so I majored in film at CU, not realizing that CU back then, especially because Stan Brakhage was still there, was the preeminent experimental film school in the country, or one of them. And that was really the whole show there. It was all about like hand painting on celluloid and making like weird tone poems about death. And, it was not about narrative filmmaking. And I suspect that's changed just because of student demand. Most students want to make, if they want to major in film studies, they want to make movies. They don't want to, most of them don't want to hand paint celluloid like Stan did, like beautifully, And I think too, I was graduating from film school just a couple of years after Trey Parker and Matt Stone had been on campus. They dropped out, but they had been in the film school and had made a film. I want to say they made a feature. I'm totally blanking on what it was, but it was kind of like a low budget feature. And then they were working at an animation studio in downtown Denver, or kind of hiding out there, making the earliest cuts of those South Park characters. So I would think that in the intervening years, the school has shifted more toward narrative, like film and television stuff, but who knows? And I was just there smoking entirely too much pot. And, we would make films with these 16 millimeter, the Bolex 16 millimeter cameras, and you're just with your friends at the park. You know how it is with film school stuff, unless you're very gifted and have a good sense of what you're doing. But me, it was just kind of it's almost like a goof.
Yeah. I just turned 42 and I went to, I graduated high school in 99 and I went to, there's a good community college program here for still photography. So that's what I started going to, but that was right the last few years of them still doing film. So everything we did was on film, all the different formatted cameras. And so same kind of thing. I really loved what I did. And I was just going through today, they got a film scanner, so I'm scanning all these old negatives and it's kind of like jogging some memories, but it didn't help my career in any way. Like everything I learned is like this, I think it gave me a better eye for sure for certain things visually, and just like slowing down and doing the process that way. But it is kind of interesting how it's like, there's this like this thing I went to school for that's no longer really there anymore,
Well, yeah. I mean, I have a buddy who went to Savannah College of Art and Design as a still photographer, same age as me. We were, high school buddies and graduated the same year. And then he goes off to study photography and be a still photographer. And I cannot imagine a profession that has been more disrupted by technology than photography, because cameras have gotten so sophisticated, digital photography, the Photoshop, even the filters on Instagram give people a level of control and, you know, at least some degree of professional quality can be had right there on your smartphone in ways that it never could have prior. So
no, I know my camera is better than my first digital SLR camera that is still working, and that would cost me a fortune at the time, and my dumb little phone is knocking out better quality things.
Yeah, my buddy convinced me to buy, what was it, like a Canon 5D?
Yeah,
is that right?
Yeah.
One of those, because it was state of the art back in the day, and I probably paid $1,000 for it or something, but I never really used it all that much. It's because the phone technology just started to take off.
Yeah.
So lesson learned, I guess.
That's funny. Well, let's talk about, the podcast, Other People Podcast, it kind of came to me. I'm a newer fan to it, but how I found it was, like people kept mentioning it to me. I've done my show for 2 years, in the podcast version of it. I've had an online whatever before, but, people, it kept getting mentioned. And then my favorite living writers now, when I would just search them on Google Podcasts, they'd all been on your show. That's how I started listening to it. And I'm like, I really dig this. I should mention there's over 800 episodes right now. It started in 2011. I'm a fan now. I have plenty of back episodes to dig through for the foreseeable future. I guess starting, going back to 2011, that was still kind of, podcast was a, relatively new form. It would have been around, but, most people can't say they go back to the early 2010s and keep doing it like on a weekly basis. So I would just love to hear, I know you've mentioned it on the podcast at times, but for our listeners, if they haven't heard, just when did this idea come to you to, produce a weekly podcast, and what has kept you maintaining it week after week over the years?
Well, I think that it initially began as kind of a lark and an experiment and something that I conceived of as being totally temporary. I thought I would do 10 or 20 episodes and just be done with it. And the show is called Other People with Brad Listy. And sometimes I'll have listeners ask me about the name of the show, like just to give you an indication of how little thought I put into any of it. Like it's the most literal name of a show's other, because it's an interview show. I'm talking to somebody essentially for an hour, just like this. And I was like, okay, so we'll just call it Other People with Brad Listy. And now I'm, 12 years into it and 800 and some odd episodes into it. And I think at the beginning it was a kind of an experimental thing, and it quickly became something that, like, I think so many people who do long form interview shows or conversational podcasts find is that it gives you a lot. You learn a lot from it. You feel nourished by it. It's a way to connect with people in the absence of cell phone technology. There's a level of attention and a depth of exchange that you don't get as an adult, maybe most of the time, because you're in a professional context where things are busy and stressful, or you're in a family context where you have to be talking in the language of a six-year-old or whatever it is, And so I think that's a lot of why these kinds of shows have proliferated. I think there's also a money aspect. People like, I sort of bristle at this, but in the beginning, celebrities wanted nothing to do with podcasts because it was considered this sort of ghetto, fake poser format, you had a podcast if you couldn't get on the radio. And then once they realized there was actual money to be made, mm-hmm. now they all are doing it and they gobble up a lot of the oxygen in the audience. I guess that's inevitable, but it's kind of like, I don't know. Do I sound bitter?
No. Well, no, like I guess it, I hear you. Like, I love Michelle Obama, but like, I just noticed she has a new podcast. I'm like, ah, of course, like she's, you know, yeah. Conan O'Brien. It's another, you know, interview, long form interview. And I'm sure it's great, but it, yeah, you're right. It's like everyone's doing it.
Well, it's a wonderful medium, and I don't, on a human level, I don't fault anybody, but it is interesting to me because I will listen to shows like you just mentioned, Conan. I've heard his show, and I've heard him on his show say that it's the most meaningful and his favorite thing that he's ever done. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason why is that he's not constrained by, you know, some sort of corporate agenda. He doesn't have to fit an entire conversation with somebody inside of like a 7-minute window, and he doesn't have to get 3 laughs a minute, and, you know, all the different kind of constraints that are put upon you when you're trying to do broadcast television in a half an hour format or whatever it is. And so there's a lot of freedom, and it really can be meaningful. And I think at the very dawn of my show, I was responding to my frustration with social media, which I ended up writing about in my novel, and which is kind of ongoing. It'll never go away. And I think what I was feeling when I started the podcast was that I had had enough of two-dimensional presentations of self that left to me so much to be desired. I didn't feel like I was really connecting with anyone or knew exactly who anyone was anymore. It's kind of that feeling of destabilization and this sense that people are curating themselves, and it's just kind of just bullshit. And so I was like, well, I want to talk to people. I want to actually like take whoever it is, you know, who keeps appearing in my timeline, and I want to get on the phone with them or get on Skype with them or whatever it was in the beginning. And I want to have a conversation. And so the show was really that simple in its conception at the beginning. And it was really loose and much less quote unquote professional than it is now. It was much more about community building. It was much more about improvisational conversation. I think I've become more of a professional interviewer since then. Part of me wonders if it's a good thing. Like, I think my theory of the case is that when you do truly improvisational conversations with people whom you've often never met before, the highs can be really high and the lows can be really low. So the quality of the content, I think, is probably more uneven. But when it's good, it's better than it is when you get all prepared. It's weird. But like when you are improvising with somebody and it's going well, it's great. And when it's not, it's probably hell for the listener.
I can attest to that on both sides of it, you know. But I think, so one thing that I really love about your, you know, I guess we could call it style of interviewing, one thing that keeps me like wanting to listen and you know, I'm excited that I have so many back episodes and you've interviewed everybody, like so many Almost. Writers pretty much. And I love the way that you don't cut people off when they're talking, you don't cut them off. You're an excellent listener, but you're also guiding the conversation. And it seems like you're very familiar with the book, you know, that the person is coming on to talk about or promote or whatever. So I think, I don't know if there's a question in this, and I'm just like, a good interview is like you said, you know, it can be incredible, and I may not be able to articulate like what is a good interview, but I can tell when it's a bad interview.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's like, it's weird. It's funny you say that, because I'll have conversations sometimes on the show that are just so good and so effortless. And I'll know that it's real when I get to the edit and I'm having to do very little. And I'm listening to the playback and I'm going through, and it's like neither of us had barely a hiccup. And I genuinely wonder about why. Like, is this a person that I should get to know better? Like, we clicked so easily the first time we ever spoke and had this incredibly meaningful conversation, a conversation of such depth and nuance and emotion that exceeds the kinds of conversations that I have with friends of mine who I've known since I was 7 years old or whatever, you know, yeah. And so I wonder if it's some sort of personal chemistry, or is it just that we're two people who happen to be at our best that day? Like the way that you just have good energy and your brain is clicking, you know, on a certain day, and maybe so was theirs. Or is it that they have a book to promote and I read that book and understand it, or at least understand what, you know, what they were going for. And, you know, maybe it's just really that kind of transactional exchange. Maybe it's a combination of all of the above, but you can sit around, or if you're anything like me, you can sit around after one such conversation and you can be wondering for a long time, like why it, you know, why it is so powerful, like why it feels it sounds so precious, but it's like nourishing. Oh. You just feel good after you have one of those really good conversations. And so that's what keeps you doing it. You know, it's like you have enough of those and you're kind of always chasing after the next one.
No, I mean, I'm just a little over 100 episodes right now. And I still feel like I'm finding my feet with it. It was just, and mine came, like a lot of people's, it came out of the pandemic, like being socially isolated, and I needed some kind of community or connection. And, you know, it was very, for very selfish reasons. I just wanted to talk to people. And then I know exactly what you mean. Like you have those ones that it's like, oh, that went really well. And I'm like on a high for several days. Like it's all I need at, you know, for, you know, a given week or whatever. But it is, I mean, I love hearing how people, well, you know, cause it's an art form to how to interview somebody. I heard, Mark Summers, that old game show host from that kid's show Double Dare back in like the 90s. He was on Mark Maron's podcast recently and was talking about his new podcast that he has.
Of course, yeah.
But it was like such a fascinating interview. He talked a lot about when he was starting out, and he was like on local TV, wherever he was from. And, you know, he was about to get fired, but I think one of the producers, from what I'm remembering, one of the producers was like, I went to bat for you. I'm giving you one more shot. And so here, like, basically here's the packet of the info for the guest tomorrow. Like study this tonight. And then the next morning he gets there and the guy's like, did you go over that? And he said, yeah. And he's like, forget everything that you read in that and just go out there and talk to the guy. And so that's what he said has been one of his, you know, staying bit of advice, where he prepares, and then tries to forget it all and then go into the conversation. I don't know how you approach it. I know, so I have a lot of authors on mine. I have a lot of filmmakers as well. I love having authors on, but I, you know, it's a lot more work to prepare.
Thank you. I sit around sometimes listening to like comedians talk to comedians, or I listen to people interview a filmmaker, and I will thoroughly enjoy the conversation, but I'm sitting there so envious because I know that they only had to watch a 90-minute film to get ready.
Yeah.
Or listen to a few tracks off of an album. Like I'm doing two interviews a week, which means I'm reading two books a week. This past week, and this is actually the perfect example. It's not always like this, but this past week I read a nonfiction book called 70x7, which is all about capital punishment and the story of a 15-year-old girl who committed murder and was put on death row and was sentenced to die in the electric chair. So that was one like 450-page book that I read. And then I followed it up with a book by Clancy Martin called How Not to Kill Yourself, A Portrait of the Suicidal Mind, which is like a 500-page book. And this is back to back, you know, I'm reading these things inside of 6 days or whatever. And that's an intense amount of reading. It's many hours of prep. And to talk about it intelligently and to guide a conversation over the course of like an hour or 90 minutes requires having a pretty good grasp and having a detailed, you know, what I find is you need some notes. And like you say, you can then abandon them as the situation dictates. But, you know, if you're going to talk about somebody's book, you need to have some scaffolding, because otherwise you're going to lose the listeners. And one of the other challenges about it is that most of the listeners haven't read it. I would say 99% of the people listening haven't read it. So you have to build a conversation that can engage somebody like that. So it adds a certain layer, but yeah, the prep is intense, and the labor of doing a literary interview show in the way that I do it now is a lot, but it's very rewarding. And the books are more often than not excellent. And it's really a good time for people who like to read. I think it's, I cannot imagine there's ever been a better time. There are so many great books being published, and too few people know about it, which is a lot of the reason why I keep doing my show. You know, it's frustrating to read a book that you feel like is a masterpiece and to know that probably 1,000 people got their hands on it. It's insane.
No, I completely agree. Like, Bruce Wagner, he's one of my favorite authors. And, I had read his most recent book, Roar. I'd read the whole thing, and that's a beast of a book, as you know, like, as far as length. I mean, it's an amazing, like, the guy's a genius as far as I'm concerned. It's a long book. It took me a while to get through that. And then I listened to your episode with him talking about Roar, and that's what sold me. Like, I'd heard a few other episodes and I really enjoyed your show, but that kind of, like, you clearly read the book, and I'm like, I've heard other interviews with him, and, you know, I don't think they read the book.
You can tell. And I think that, you know, going back to what I was saying about having these exchanges and wondering at their power and why it went well and why it felt so good. You know, for somebody who has spent years of their life, oftentimes in the trenches, toiling in obscurity, enduring failure, and often like poverty, you know, all the things that it takes to write a book, it's a lot. It's uniquely difficult. It's uniquely difficult as a creative undertaking to write a full book. And so if you honor that effort by actually reading the book with care and then talking to that person about it, just as the book is publishing, to meet somebody at that moment in their life, it's a special time, you know, and it's also a fraught time. There's a lot of emotion that authors feel. I know it, you know, I know it myself as an author. When your book finally is out there, like, you've done it, it's externalized. And so I think when you come to a conversation like that and talk to the author about their book in a way that makes it clear that you've read it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's meaningful to them. And it's also respectful, you know, but
yeah.
I say that, and in earlier versions of this podcast, you know, it was more about the author and their life story and maybe some of their creative habits and just who they were as people. And the book was of lesser import. And so the show has kind of evolved in the direction of the book. And I think part of it is wanting to maybe honor the creative process more in that way. Though I don't feel like I was being disrespectful in the beginning. I didn't know what I was doing. Mm-hmm. But I think also it's just to try to keep the show new for me. I mean, you get 800 episodes in, you've got to try new ways of doing it to sort of give yourself new challenges, I think, and to keep it interesting, to keep yourself kind of on your toes.
Yeah. I'm really curious how, when I talk to writers, just the amount, I think, well, you know, we're all busy. We all have lives and different things. But I think especially writers, like, the juggling act that they have to perform, because, you know, even the best writers are not making a living as a writer. They have to teach or they have to do whatever. So there's all these other things that they have to juggle in order to keep writing. So I'm just like, you know, the amount of episodes that you have, and then like, and then, and you write, you're a writer, you have, I think three published books right now. And so how, and then I haven't checked it out yet, but that literary collective, The Nervous Breakdown, there's all these things, you know, you have a family. How do you balance, how do you manage time? Like, I don't know how you do it. I'm just so overwhelmed. When I try to do what I'm doing, and I see, you know, someone like you, that's like, how are you just very organized? How do you do it?
Yeah. I think you have to be organized. You have to be disciplined, but I mean, it's not a perfect, I'm not perfect at the level of execution, and balance is something that I'm always struggling with. I work a lot. I work 7 days a week. Usually sometimes I take Sunday off. I try to, so that I can just like have a day with my kids, but you know, it's just what it takes. I'm doing all, like, just for the show alone, I'm doing everything. I do the prep. I have no, you know, I have no help. So I do the prep. There's no producer helping me get my ducks in a row. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just me. So I'm reading the book, I'm taking notes, I'm researching online, I'm conducting the interview itself. And then I do all the post-production, the editing of the audio, the, you know, I'm picking out musical tracks and, you know, getting it scored and all that kind of stuff. You know, like, it's a lot. And then there's the promotion of the episode. So the social media, editing of video clips, putting the YouTube edition up, getting TikTok and Instagram figured out, Twitter, all of it, you know, like, that stuff is the time suck. So it's like, you know, my days begin at like 6:30 or 7:00. And I'm usually, like, these days I'm wrapping up work at like 8:30 at night, 7 days a week.
Wow.
So, and then it's like, you know, I'm trying to write my next book in the midst of it all. I'm trying to do freelance work to, you know, make ends meet. There are all these different like hustles that I'm doing to try to patch together enough income. And it's not easy. It's really not. It's such a struggle. And it's not a struggle for me alone. It's a struggle for, I think, the entire creative class in this country, with the exception of the lucky 1%. Mm-hmm. You know, why does everything in this country seem to, and maybe around the world, seem to sort itself out in that kind of lopsided fashion, you know, where you have really 1% of the creative class making all the money and everybody else just like scrapping.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's difficult. And I have a lot of sympathy for people who are fighting that fight. And I think that another thing that keeps me going as a podcaster is just this devotion I feel to the writing community, like this tribe, and the work that these people do to make meanings, like to make really deep meanings out of language and to tell stories in this way. It's so grueling. And comparatively speaking, you know, if you're going to put it up against film and television or music or, you know, these other kind of more popular forms of entertainment, I find it incredibly moving for somebody to tell me in my, you know, in the context of a podcast conversation, that they spent 8 years writing this beautiful novel that they wrote, knowing that that novel is only going to sell 726 copies. That's a common outcome. That's actually, I think, better than the average book sale.
Yeah.
Like, people don't realize how hard it is to find a readership and to make any money at all, no matter how good the book is. And I will always push back against people who say, well, if the art is good enough, it will find an audience. Mm-hmm. It's not true. It's not true. Like, why certain books, you know, catch a wave while others do not is a mystery, I think, to everybody, even the people who catch the wave, maybe especially them, if they're being honest. And of course, the work itself has to be good. Of course, it has to have the elements of, you know, a good story, and all the kind of fundamentals, you know, have to be working. But for most people, it is just a strange risk, you know, risk reward equation. And I feel a real affinity with people who do that. And I think the podcast is my little way of trying to like shine a light on that work and to help bring readers to the work and to help perpetuate literary culture in this country. Because I think if we lose reading, and like especially the reading of quote unquote serious books, we lose a lot. And I think we're seeing, at least to some degree, the costs of having, you know, too much of an illiterate culture in America. You know, I think, you know, you can point to a lot of, you can point to a lot of different aspects of our day-to-day reality these days and say, well, wouldn't it maybe be better? Wouldn't this be improved if we had more people who were engaging with literature and expanding their moral imaginations? I mean, I get it. I don't want to sound like a snobby writer. Sort of diatribe, I think, can turn people off. But I just think, I think that, you know, when you read a novel, and especially a novel that's maybe about characters who do not share your particular socioeconomic status or cultural background, some kind of story that takes you out of yourself and into the world and into the lives of people unlike yourself. When you do that, it expands your moral imagination. And when you expand your moral imagination, it makes you, I think, a more empathic and thoughtful and accepting and interesting person, and a person who is maybe aware of and open to the broader scope of human experience. It delivers a lot. And if you don't believe me, this is the conversation I have with my daughter. I'm like, listen, like, pay attention to how you feel after you spend 30 minutes on TikTok versus after spending 30 minutes reading a novel. Mm-hmm. Pay attention. How do you feel? And if I guarantee you, you will feel good after reading a novel. You'll feel nourished in some way. And you'll feel like you got a lobotomy after being on TikTok.
It's so true. Like, I feel when I read a book, it's like undoing all the crap that I've been putting in my head with my phone or whatever. It's like undoing that. Or, I mean, I don't know if I can undo it completely, but it's like the polar opposite. It, you know, it causes me to slow down, to think about something, to pause, to go back and reread something, where I'm just like, if I am on TikTok, just like, you know, scrolling like crazy. And I just, yeah, you feel like a lobotomy. That's for sure.
Really, I mean, TikTok. And then I think you can kind of do the same thing with videos on Instagram now, where you're just flipping and you get, it's like, it is uniquely bad. Like, it really makes my brains feel like mush. Like, I understand why people get addicted to it. That's the thing too, is like, it's really easy to suddenly, you know, start flipping and then get lost and realize that you've just wasted, you know, another half an hour of your life. Like, that's something I've done many times. So I speak from experience. And I think, like, you know, you said exactly the right word a minute ago by saying it slows you down. I mean, that's what literature is. Books are slow food. Mm-hmm. And social media is fast food, if you want to use that comparison. I mean, I think that's pretty apt. And I think we need more slow food.
Yeah. No, I know. If I take a few days or a week or two without reading, like reading a book, a novel, or nonfiction, or whatever, it's like working out in a way. It's like, it's hard, even if you're enjoying something, it's hard for me to sit back down and spend any length of time reading, because I've been training my brain, you know, just that quick, you know, short attention span. But yeah, anything good takes effort.
Well, yeah. And I've gone through periods in my life where I've had trouble reading, even during my professional years as a writer. And I think it had something to do with technology. But the good news is that, you know, I'm now reading 2 and 3 books a week. And you can get in shape that way too. And it is reversible. Yeah. You just have to carve out the time and do the reading, even if it's just a half an hour a day before bed or first thing in the morning or whenever you can do it on your lunch break. But if you're sort of committed to it, you you can get into the swing of it, and you start to realize that the benefits are significant.
I love that. I think that's a good positive thought to kind of wrap up as we, you know, as we finish up our hour. This has been really cool chatting with you, Brad. I mean, I look up to you, and I've become a fan, and I just think your show is incredible, and I'm so happy you have been doing it this long and that you keep doing it. It's just very, for me as a listener, it's nourishing. And then it turns you on to books that you had, authors you haven't heard of before. So, thank you for doing what you do. I mean, I can't imagine how the amount of time that goes into it, but I'm just so impressed. And, you're putting out a quality thing that's, very special. So thank you.
Well, I appreciate it. And I appreciate you reading my book and listening to the show and taking the time to talk with me. It's been fun.
Yeah, this has been great. So I'll have links to everything, but Other People with Brad Listy is the name of the podcast.
And can we say it's Other PPL is the spelling, just to be maximally annoying, but yes. It is important if you're searching for it.
Other PPL, yeah. Yeah, I'll have links to it. And then the latest book, Be Brief and Tell Them Everything, is out now wherever you get your books. Brad, thank you so much.
All right, thank you.